Perhaps I should just say at the beginning that I am Duncan Large and I'm Academic Director of the British Centre for Literary Translation, which is housed in the School of Literature, Drama and Creative Writing at the University of East Anglia. I know there are plenty in the audience who either are based in Norwich or who know the university and the centre, so it's very good to see so many familiar faces. And if you have not yet found your way to BCLT, then we'd love to welcome you, and BCLT is a resource for translators from whichever language. So, we have a running order, and we're going to begin with Oka, who is Kairani Barauka, and she's an Indonesian writer, poet, artist, and disability and arts advocate. She has a forthcoming edited collection, Heat, an anthology of Southeast Asian urban writing, and is the author of a poetry art book, which is one of the first titles forthcoming in the series from Tilted Axis Press, about which we will be hearing rather more later on, because we also have the founder of Tilted Axis Press here, who is Deborah Smith. Now, our title, Building New Bridges, is a very broad one, and we don't have a particular agenda, because our agenda is very, very diverse. We're talking about building bridges between languages, following on from the discussion this morning. I think it was very interesting to hear about how few bridges there exist between the languages of the Caribbean area. And so we're going to be talking in our session about building bridges between new bridges between languages. We're talking about building bridges to new readerships, and the role that is played in that process through new presses, building bridges between readers, between authors, writers, translators, and booksellers and publishers. So plenty of bridges, and I'd like to invite Oka to begin.
Good afternoon, and thank you so much to the Free Word Center and Writers Center Norwich for organizing this important event, and to Tilted Axis Press for bringing me here to be with all of you. I'd like to ask, first of all, who here counts themselves as a member of the deaf or disabled communities, or a deaf or disabled community? Anybody? Just me? Okay, excellent. So the script of this talk is available online at the address on the slide if you're not of the hearing community and would like to listen to an over-enthusiastic, awkward advocate researcher. I myself am a hearing, seeing woman who is, to explain why you might have seen me lying down earlier on the VIP sofa, a makeshift sofa, or will see me do so later. I'm proudly disabled. I'm a writer, poet, artist, and now PhD researcher at Goldsmith, so I live here now, who, since I came out as disabled 4 years ago, I have nerve damage and a nervous system condition, have been working in literature and art and translating all the while. At the intersections of various disabled and non-disabled communities, always from a disabled or CRIP perspective, but also from the perspective of someone who identifies as woman, Muslim, Indonesian, sexually fluid, and for better or worse, shock horror, an Aries. I know. Yeah, seriously. We are, as human beings, constantly translating, and we have been our whole lives. When we are children, we are translating our worldview to that of adults who often simply just don't understand why we can't have enough ice cream. The more we grow and realize that the world is a harsh and discriminatory place, we negotiate boundaries of community, locale, personal psyche, translating our positions and identities as women and or writers and or translators and or residents of London or whatever markers shape our world, both for people within those identity communities and those from outside. Deaf and disabled communities are marginalized. This is a fact. When we think of the disabled, I know many in the non-disabled world, or you non-crips out there, may have immediate pitying responses. And sadly, rarely is it acknowledged that different ways of living in the world, such as ours, with varying bodies and minds, is a gift of diversity and a gift to culture. That there are innumerable deaf and disabled cultures in the world, whether you're talking about British Sign Language slang specific to parts of the UK, or an Indonesian village in Bali that has its own indigenous sign language, Kata Kolok, or the brilliant legacy of Frida Kahlo, whether or not she identified as disabled with that word, seeping into the work of many contemporary disabled artists, skewering stereotype, convention, and the marginalization of our work as disability arts of a certain kind assumed to be non-rigorous. We are legion, and I suggest you look us up. I'm here to speak about broadening the views of translation beyond the written word and beyond the world of speech alone. When I think of translation, coming from a Crip culture's viewpoint, I think of a truly intersectional translation that dignifies deaf and disabled cultures and sees texts on the page and experiences of artworks as translatable in fascinating ways to various deaf-disabled cultures, but also from them. I see the output of literature and art by various deaf and disabled cultures as also translatable to those of you who do not identify as such. And I'm also fascinated by and learning more about the limitations of translation when it comes to accessibility. There are infinite numbers of disability variations in the world, and as I was reminded very recently by my supervisor, it is impossible to make anything universally accessible. She's like, you're a very optimistic person. I'm here to tell you. You're very utopian. There are people who cannot access literature and art by virtue of various factors. But as I was also reminded recently, that doesn't mean we shouldn't try. When we widen what accessible translation means, to go beyond translating from written word, to making work available across, between, and for various deaf and disabled communities, we're able to do projects like Even Merrier Having Coffee. Slide, please. Thank you. Which is a solo spoken word show I created and performed in various forms in London, the Edinburgh Fringe, Warwick, Vienna, and New Delhi, that was only performed in accessible venues, and which was made deaf accessible with the use of smartphone and tablet technology, bringing the script to deaf audiences. I should also add that for years I'd been performing as a spoken word poet and passing as abled and standing up, and that was really terrible for my health. So creating the show where 99% of the time I'm on the floor, literally kind of writhing around in pain in some twisted music video style performance is also me finally being comfortable and showing people, not conforming to what people might think of as spoken word performance. And throughout the course of the hour, I paint the right side and chest of my body, which is the part that has nervous system issues, with blue paint so that people finally see what is an invisible disability. We're able to do projects like the 12 Acres Project. Slide, please. Thank you. Thank you. I began last year in rural Rajasthan as part of the Equilibrium Residency at Sandarbh in Partapur, India, where the women of Bori Village Self-Help Economic Group that I was working with as equals were able to have their women-specific song stories recorded in a studio, as you can see. I'm not singing. I'm not talented enough to sing, but I'm just sitting there being distracting with all of these wonderful women from the Patidar Bori Village community. So they have stories that and songs that they only sing in their community of women. And then it was my job to translate three of these songs into picture books. Why? Initially, it was for my friend Santia Patidar, who's not pictured there, a deaf member of the by and large hearing community of Bori Village, who communicated best not through reading and writing, and had never had access her whole life, despite being much loved and respected by her community, to the feminist stories in these songs, as they had only been in audible form. And when I talk about widening translation, I was sitting in the house of Ramila Anti, who is my adoptive aunt in Rajasthan, and everybody was singing these songs, and Santia was giving me water and making sure I was okay, and I was just asking, so do you, you know, Santia, do you know the stories in these songs? Has anybody ever told you them? And the whole, everybody was just, it just some, like a light bulb came on, that audible forms of stories did not have to stay audible. that they could be translated in different ways. And her family was really excited. She has a hearing son and a hearing husband, and the community really got behind it. And it wasn't a charity project, as, you know, disability arts is so often seen as, oh, well, you know, we'll provide access to stories. But it's about including her in a feminist community of which she was always a part. But there was so much richness in these stories that she could finally access through picture books. But accessibility has a way of multiplying itself. By making these songs accessible to deaf women, slide please. Should do like a fancy. Thank you. So this is from, these are images from the 12 Acres book. There are two more. By making these songs accessible to deaf women, we're also making them accessible to children and adults who did not understand Vagri, the oral language under threat that this music is sung in. That's spelled V-A-G-D-I. It's pronounced Vagri. This is therefore also a form of preserving cultural heritage for younger generations, and also as a way of bridging between the hearing and deaf, and honestly, between men and women. Men not having access to the context these women's songs are sung in. I'd ask men, do you know what your wife is singing? I don't know, she just like goes and sings with her friends. This type of language preservation and access creation is vital, particularly as another language goes extinct every 2 weeks, as with their loss, gendered understandings of each word and song are also lost. And lost, too, are handed down stories for women to find their strength in. Accessible translation is a feminist act, and it is imperative for the global South, as we disabled women everywhere in the world, but particularly in the global South, are more marginalized, vulnerable, abused, neglected, and discriminated against than non-disabled women already are. And we deserve more stories that give us power to change our circumstances. And by creating accessible stories that come from marginalized groups, this is also what Petra Cuppers, who is another artist, writer, and academic, calls decolonizing disability. I see accessibility as always a form of translation. Everyone sees the world differently, and accessible translation is a form of presenting different ways in living in varied bodies and minds in the world. For example, if I asked all of you to lie down on the floor, as I am most comfortable doing, you would automatically see the world in a different way. Perhaps you would write in a different way. Perhaps you would translate in a different way. Accessible translation is about thinking laterally, spatially, i.e. putting performances in accessible venues, changing the bird's eye view to that of perhaps little people or people like me who need to lie down. Intersectionally, i.e. something in BSL or British Sign Language would not be accessible to deaf people who speak other sign languages. And as we know that all translation is not a direct copy of the original, and is in fact in many ways the creation of an entirely new artwork, the possibilities seem endless. Translation of literature and art for and by deaf and disabled women, but really all deaf and disabled cultures, rather than marginalizing us, is fertile ground. From print and new media, there's so much to be done. Amidst so much technological change and foment, how many websites are actually accessible? How many people know how to build them? How many people who need them have access to specific reading software? Or braille versions of books, such as the tactile poetry art book Indigenous Species I'm creating for Tilted Access Press out next year, plug, plug. What opportunities can audiovisual and other technologies create for the translation of artworks from, among, and between deaf and disabled cultures and non-disabled cultures? In a nutshell, and vitally, how can we better our circumstances by bettering the diversity and accessibility of the ways that stories are told? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Oka. Tremendous. I was interested, perhaps if I could just ask a first question and then we'll open up. I was interested in the section where you're talking about the impact of technology, and you're suggesting that so many websites do not have a properly accessible version and so on. But it would nonetheless seem to be the case that the impact of technology on opening up accessibility is profound in recent decades. And I'm wondering whether you would argue that it has been primarily a kind of change of political consciousness, or actually the availability of new technologies, which has been most helpful in taking forward this agenda?
Well, both. But I also think that increasingly there are... I think that there needs to be more opportunities for people within deaf and disabled cultures to create their own technologies. There are lots of people who are already hackers and makers, just because you have to survive in the world and you have to make your own technology. You know, in Indonesia, I have friends who are part of the IT Center for the Blind. It's a blind couple, and they make their own things because, you know, they need to be able to access the world in a certain way. And I think there needs to be more opportunities for deaf and disabled cultures to create their own media, to create their own storytelling platforms, our own storytelling platforms, and for us to foment that change from within, rather than it being a sort of charity model where it's, you know, providing, although that is absolutely imperative because that's where the power is, that's where the resources are at the moment. So I think both political consciousness and the proliferation of new technological means are hand in hand, but they also need to go with where is the access to that political drive, where is the access to those means of creating new technologies and new media forms.
Thank you. Okay. Yes. Can I open up to any other questions to Oka's presentation?
I wanted to ask about that term you use, crypt culture.
Yeah.
Because I suppose that must evoke strong feelings. Can people say it? Can they not? Do they want to be part of it? Do they sort of not want? So is it, does that help accessibility, or may it sometimes limit accessibility?
Well, disabled cultures are not a monolith by being plural alone. You know, we're a plurality. In Indonesian, the word is difabel, that we've created from differently abled, because Indonesians love acronyms. We have acronyms for everything. This event would be an acronym. It would be like TM at, you know, translation. So in Indonesian, it's difabel. But I use crip culture because for me it seems more political and in your face, and because it's something that people don't like saying. Oh, you know, there's a lot of academic work on it. There's a lot of artistic work and literary work on it. There's Crip 3, the book by Robert McCruer. And some people don't like people define themselves however they want. I remember speaking at an event in Melbourne, and one man said, you know, I don't like using the term disabled. I am mangled. And I felt, I mean, just saying it right now, it makes me feel like, oh, I don't want to use that word about myself, you know. But he was most comfortable using that word, and he hated the word disabled. I think one thing that is very important that I didn't mention is that the word disabled is the opposite of unabled with an E, not unable with a U. Using the social model of disability, disabled means that society has not enabled us to do certain things. That's really, really crucial. Because if, the medical model of disability is that, you know, being disabled means that we are flawed, that we can't do certain things. But the social model is actually, you know, accessibility. It's, yeah. Oh, sorry. Yeah, sure.
Yeah. Proudly say themselves as coolies. When I was in Australia telling someone about my research a few years ago, and I used this word coolie, which I have friends, David Babdine, Shivani Singh, and people like that, who talk about this stuff, who share the word, who allow me to comment on it. You know, these white Australians got very angry. They said, you can't use that word. You know, they didn't understand the context.
Yeah.
I wasn't being pejorative. I was trying to explain what my friends are researching.
But limiting them how, in terms of some people might not be comfortable saying crip.
Yeah, or other people might not be comfortable hearing them.
Why wouldn't they be comfortable?
For that reason, I've just
explained. I see.
You can't use that word.
Well, I think that's the fascination of just living in a turbulent language clashing world and viewpoint clashing world. I mean, some people might be offended by me being a woman. You know, I mean, I don't think it's up to. I think Crip culture is very empowering for myself and many people I know within the community, and I don't think it's up to us to make sure everybody else is not offended, because that is, you know, it's. I like that people feel uncomfortable. As somebody said to me recently, who also works in disability cultures, I like the word discomfort, and I like being discomforted, because we're discomforted all the time. We're discomforted all the time when something is inaccessible to us, whether it's a story, whether it's a room. And to have other people be discomforted is also, to be honest, a form of translation. It's a form of translating experience. So I'm all for discomfort. I'm all for clashing. And what comes out of that is super interesting, I think. Yeah.
And you were just saying about things that empower you.
Yeah.
And using, you know, your way of movement and your way of speaking, your way of translating your experience, you know, doing it in a way that's specific to you. And you used the word empower just in what you were saying.
Yeah.
And I was wondering, what is empowering to you? What do you find empowering? Is it collaborations? Is it trying to make your experience
gosh, what is empowerment? I know, I mean, because, you know, I'm a disabled brown woman, please empower me is just such a, you know, an easy thing for people to think. So I think self-empowerment is the most important thing. Or I was reading recently re-empowerment, because empowerment implies that, you know, we have lost some power somewhere along the line historically or culturally. So re-empowerment. And I wish I remembered the name of the person who wrote that. But I think also it's sometimes I really hate that word empowerment, because it implies so many, you know, as though marginalized means somehow lesser, potentially. But I think there's a lot of strength, which is a word I like better, in collaborations on equal footing, dignifying deaf and disabled cultures, and seeing deaf and disabled people, especially women, as equals. And I think that is so incredibly rare. I really think the majority of the way that deaf and disabled cultures are spoken of is so pejorative and demeaning and charity-based, rather than perceiving us as artists and writers and translators in our own right.
I think thank you very much. I think we'll have continuing contributions from all of our speakers in the course of the session, I hope. But we should move on now and thank Oka for now, and move on to our next speaker, who is going to be James Byrne. James is a poet living in Liverpool, and he lectures in creative writing at Edgehill University. James is the international editor of ARC Publications, who are very active in publishing translated work, and James has published a number of his own collections with ARC and other publishers, most recently Blood Sugar in 2009. James is co-editor of the first anthology of Burmese poetry published in the West, came out from ARC in 2012, and I think he's going to be talking about that experience and about Burmese poetry in his remarks now. James also has the experience of having been translated into several other languages himself. So if I could pass on to James.
Thank you, Duncan, and thank you for a great talk. Congratulations on your book as well. It's great. Can you all hear me? Is this working? I'm going to be very offhand. That was very fluid and really informative and great and really engaging, but I'm just going to start. I'm going to be so offhand that I'm actually going to start with a few lines of poetry, actually, because poetry was my way into translating. So, as Duncan said, I co-edited a book of Burmese poetry. It took about 6 years, and we didn't have any template. It hadn't been done before. There were translations from what is called the Kitsan times, really around the 1930s in Burma, Myanmar, I should say, because it's one of those only countries in the world that is named twice, both of the namings wrong, both of them right, depending on which side you're on. So I started working with Burmese poets by accident, and I edit a poetry magazine called The Wolf, and we were going to do a feature on Pakistani poetry, and it didn't happen for a number of reasons. And in my disappointment about that, I went to the British Library and I started thinking about a friend of mine has said, well, why don't you look at Burmese poetry? So I did, and I realized I was trying to call up books at the British Library about Burmese poetry, and they weren't there. They didn't exist. And maybe this is a reflection of my temperament, but I immediately became really angry about that and disappointed. Disappointed, I suppose, the main thing. Anger maybe came later. And then I wanted to do something about it, which came within a couple of days. And what I did is I said I was going to read a poem. Maybe I should just do that. But the first poet that I found is the guy who I'm going to read from now, and his name is Zaya Lin. And I suppose he convinced me to pursue this project, which I knew was going to come at possibly one of the worst times of my life to take on something new. I was just about to move to New York City. And I read a poem from Zaya Lin, literal translation, by my co-editor, Coco Thet. And Coco Thet and I were both of us really, well, floored really by this poem. And then we found out something significant about it. So I don't need to hold this up as an advertisement, but it's from the book, and I'll just read you a few lines from it. So the poem is called My History Is Not Mine. I am already dead. I can say this unreservedly. It was not me who wrote my history. 11 out of 10 people don't know me. Historians have no idea about my history, written by historians. PhD scholars, they might have written my history, but I don't remember it. And the poem goes on, it mentions the word history, such an important word to Burmese writers, cross genres, but particularly in poetry. Burma is a poetry-obsessed country. Obviously the quality of the poem I noticed immediately, even from the literal translation. But I then found out, Coco Thet found out and relayed it to me, that Zaya Lin had decided, you remember the first line, I am already dead, I can say this unreservedly. And Zaya Lin was very curious he was concerned and perhaps even a little bit petrified, given that Burma was still very much a country that was poetry is heavily censored. And so he decided to put the poem in the past tense. The poet is already dead, so they can say these things. And he did that in order to get the poem through censorship. And I found this an extraordinary story. I'm condensing it into, perhaps too neatly. But that was sort of the tipping point, the catalyst. And I decided that I was going to work on Burmese poetry with Coco Thet. But we didn't have much to work from. And there were several poets, because of censorship, I don't want to patronize anyone here, you probably know about Burma, but it was a country under heavy military censorship for near on 50 years. And you had, I'll just give you an example, you had the dictator who lasted the longest was General Ne Win. And Ne Win, his name loosely translates as sunrise, Ne Win, sunrise. And he actually banned the use of the word sunset because he thought you would be trying to kill him. Literally, I mean, very superstitious. Dictators are often superstitious people. Anyway, very superstitiously, he decided that he was going to ban the use of the word sunset. And subsequent words were banned as well, like mother. You couldn't say mother in a particular context, because, as some of you might know, Aung San Suu Kyi, one of her nicknames is the mother of the country, the great hope still for the country. And so with the process of selection for the anthology, and I'm going back through memory here, trying to remember it coherently, but there were several poets we wanted to include who were too worried to be included in the anthology. And the very last thing in terms of, you know, a translator's responsibility, I don't want to send anyone to jail. And we had many meetings about that, many Skype conversations and emails, and et cetera, about who to include. And there were three, I think, great poets whose reputation has perhaps now suffered because there hasn't been an anthology published since. So I was sad about that, and I still am. And I hope now, of course, Burma is living in... I mean, it still has a kind of secret... or it's rather, I suppose, it's implied that it's democratic. Hillary Clinton's been there. David Cameron showed up in his tie and shirt and sweating buckets and... what an idiot. Anyway, political persuasions aside. But anyway, he was there, and you know, people think that things have changed in Burma. But now, of course, you have a country where certain poets are known. They're still not, and I hope to change this or help change things a little bit in this country, whereby we do publish a full single volume of a Burmese poet. But as the country has seemed to, or been seen as democratic-leaning and so on, people think that actually Burma is doing okay, and it's not the case at all. In fact, you have a country that's surviving from various different massacres, like the massacre in 1988 being very significant to the... lot of writers, artists were killed and subsequently jailed. Some of those poets now emerging from jail. The country has massive education problems. I won't go into that. But in terms of... The poetry, you now have a post-88 generation whose voice, they actually want to define themselves as post-massacre generation, and that their voice is not really being heard. There's some really interesting work, because translation, the other way around, so from English languages and other languages, but mostly English, getting through into, translated into Burmese. So you have some very significant American poets, for example, like John Ashbery, Charles Bernstein, very linguistically innovative poets who are very much part of the young poet's psyche. They're, you know, they are as important as T.S. Eliot, let's say. In fact, if you could take this as an example, Mayakovsky, Vladimir Mayakovsky's Cloud in Trousers, is a much more important poem than The Wasteland. So they're really interested in an innovative poetics. I mean, it's a better poem, maybe, anyway. But they're very interested in this idea of an innovative poetics, but it's not necessarily being represented. And I suppose I should summarise, really, by saying that that it could be much more simple if there were, as I think Olive and Jonathan also made comments about funding earlier on, very important. And if I can just re-echo some of those sentiments... you know, we are still quite Eurocentric when it comes to translations. That's an issue. And we have the Arts Council, the British Council, doing terrific things. Don't get me wrong. I work with them both. And in fact, the British Council enabled me to go to Burma for the first time, which was, you know, really foundational for the anthology. And I appreciate that. But it used to be the case that any... Well, a writer, a poet, in my case, I would be able to travel somewhere, make an easier application. I just go and work with the poets there. Now you have to justify a lot of these things. So the bridge, you know, we're talking about bridges here. Bridges need foundations, and strong foundations, obviously. So the point I'm making is that, you know, funding is really important here to enable writers and translators to work together, and we don't have a framework that supports good art. I mean, from as Duncan said, I work at a university, and you know, we have to justify creative activities through things like impact. What kind of impact? How many people does it change the lives of? It's bullshit, frankly. And you know, we have to work within this framework, and so there are problems. And yet, you know, I'm working at the moment with poets from Syria. Again, it's very difficult to think about how might we get things funded. But of course, we're very passionate. You know, the translators are all obsessed with their work to some degree. Very passionate, well, all of them, you'd think, would be obsessed about literature and language. So language, as a point of contact, which is what Levinas declared it to be, language is contact, communication. Translation for me is very much about making contact. And that brings up a whole set of ethical issues. But that contact not being made with this younger generation of poets in Burma, and if there were a bit more of a helpful funding apparatus, then the poets are waiting, you know, for it to happen. So hopefully it will. I think that's all. I'll stop there.
Thank you. Thank you. Ending on an optimistic note, impact is bullshit. Discuss. That's perhaps a conversation for another day.
Don't send that one to my employer.
No.
Thank you.
Yes, edited highlights will be available. BCLT, I should say, have been to Burma, Myanmar as well, and my former colleague Kate Griffin, who is now working just next door in the Writers' Centre. She facilitated a translation workshop in Burma. I wonder if I could ask you, James, because I'm thinking about this morning and the discussion following Ollie's presentation, thinking about context. And one thing that came up was, well, one way of establishing context is to publish more. I think this was your point, Deborah, wasn't it? And it's one thing to have a first collection, but what about a second and a third? And I know we're going to be hearing very shortly from another of my panelists, Georgina, who is also the editor of a first anthology, in her case, an anthology of Francophone African women poets into English. And I was wondering, perhaps, James, if I could ask you, because thinking about your anthology, and you were saying that there hasn't been a second anthology, and I'm wondering if it's a bit like kind of the second album for a band, the difficulty of following on, and whether you yourself have tried to work towards a second volume. Is that for others? Are there specific difficulties? You're mentioning perhaps for the writers who you've included in your anthology, perhaps there have been difficulties and they wouldn't want to be involved in a project like that again. I wonder if you could say a bit more about that.
Yeah, sure. Just briefly, I'd say that there have been two books published within Burma, Myanmar, and one of them was a very good book of younger women poets, because it was very difficult for us to have access to find the best women poets in Burma, because a lot of the people we were asking were men, and it's a man's sport still in Burma. I mean, I think that's a real problem, and that brings up other wider issues. So the first anthology, I would say, edited by a poet in this book called Pandora, she, in response to Bones Will Crow, she published a book of Burmese women poets. You can find it probably in about five places in Europe, and that's a real pity. It would be great if a publisher would consider taking it on. And I would like to be part of something like that, absolutely. Mm. The other anthology is the younger 88 generation. That's only available in Burma. Mm-hmm. I think there are some plans afoot. I mean, I know a couple of things where a follow-up anthology has been discussed at some length, but nothing concrete. Mm. And for my part, I would definitely like to stay away from that. I mean, I really enjoyed working with Koko Thet. He translated the canon of Burmese poetry, and then we looked at literal translations, and that was how we worked. Okay. Which is partly why it took so long. But he produced a massive amount of work. So perhaps there's some offcuts from Bones Will Crow that could be published. The book could have been three times the size. But I would really like to see a book of younger Burmese poets who are now struggling within the country to have, as I said earlier, to be heard.
Thank you.
Does that help?
Indeed. Again, can I open up if there are questions from the audience or from other panelists?
You can save my questions for later. Okay.
Can I perhaps then ask about the political context of translation itself within Burma, Myanmar? Are there objections to work being translated at all? I imagine there might well be.
Well, that's a good question. I mean, it's an issue of language. I mean, near on 100 languages spoken in Myanmar. So, you know, you've got... And, of course, Burmese is the language that gets translated almost every time. The British Council have done something extraordinary recently in the sense that they're producing an anthology of poets from all the languages, or as many as they can translate from within the country. Mm. And that's a project which I've been involved with, and it's called the H2 Project. It's terrific that the languages within the languages of the country... Mm. Which obviously brings about a different poetics or, you know, whichever genre. So that's really important. And I think that relates to what Olive was saying in her keynote about, you know, some of the cultural connotations here are so important here with regard to publishing also.
I have a question, actually, because with this anthology that we're doing, trilogy of anthologies of urban writing set in Southeast Asia, we really wanted to get writers from all across ASEAN. But because it's limiting in itself, because the entries have to be in English and can be translations. But this idea of translating within the Southeast Asian community, it seems to be very British translators and translating workshops. But I was wondering what you thought about engagement within the region and making the region stronger, because we're trying to get more.
That would be ideal.
Yeah,
and it's possible because, there are so many talented translators within the country. For example, Zaya Lin, who I read from earlier on, yes, he's a translator. He's translated everyone from, you know, Auden to Plath to Ashbury. And, I mean, it's a phenomenal amount of work, particularly for a man who runs a school that employs 9 members of staff. And he's also a great poet. And so I think, you know, if there were, again, a kind of apparatus there, you know, with investment from all different places, potentially, that could be really exciting.
Sorry, but it's just the issue of investment, or is there still some kind of idea of what is important to translate in, because what is culturally significant, you know, translating the Western canon, like Auden and Plath, but would there be as many, say, Burmese poets who would know other Southeast Asian languages and would translate their canons? Yeah. Is it simply the lack of funding, or is it that people aren't choosing to learn these languages and translate from them because they don't have that same kind of...
Yeah, that's a really pertinent question, actually, particularly with the fact that so many of the educated Burmese are, you know, having to go and do often very laborious jobs in places like Thailand, neighbouring. So you have so many good... potentially, you know, bilingual, trilingual, they could translate, you know, Thai, Chinese, of course. I mean, from Mandalay upwards, it's really a kind of almost a Chinese state. Can I say that without being assassinated within the next hour? Maybe. So I think, you know, there's so many people who speak several languages who are able to translate, so I can't see any barriers there. I think there's maybe a more of a crucial problem in terms of how to justify these things in the 21st century. Often it's about partnerships, isn't it? Of course, you know, here we are at a great event with lots of really important partnerships. It's hard to establish those in a country like Burma. I mean, of course, the West goes there and wants to make trade deals, and, you know, the Chinese now have their port, really, which is what they've wanted. But the arts, of course, comes very low on the list, doesn't it?
Can I perhaps just ask one final question with your hat on as editor for ARC? And the book was published by ARC then. Can I ask about distribution and about whether ARC is looking to distribute the book within Burma or otherwise where in the West?
Yeah, it's difficult. I mean, on 3 visits, I took suitcases of the books and we gave them to a bookshop And then I had no clothes to wear, you know, for a week, but that's no problem. But, you know, I was just taking books over there for the first year and a half.
Okay.
There is a place, if you ever go to Burma, which I really recommend, particularly before Starbucks gets there, and other things. And there's always good reasons to go to Burma. But you go to Pan Sodan Gallery. So there's one bookshop that sells it in Yangon, you know. So it's been a real problem getting distribution. It's hard enough sending a letter to Burma and hoping it arrives. Mm. So getting books, they'll obviously be, you know, they would be in the pound straight away. And, you know, we have had some distribution successes. There was the first festival, international festival of Burmese poetry, sorry, Burmese literature post-censorship, which Aung San Suu Kyi was involved with as well. And, you know, people were buying this book it sold out within a day and a half. Because, of course, they didn't know when it would arrive again. One thing I'd really like to do, and I probably shouldn't announce this in public, is just to have another way of finding the book where you don't have to buy it. That would be great. But I have no plans, of course. I'm not involved in anything like that.
We'll just leave that one suspended, shall we?
Thanks, Duncan.
Thank you, James, and let's move on to our next speaker, who is Georgina Collins. Georgina is a lecturer in translation studies at Glasgow University and a freelance translator herself from French to English. Her work focuses on Francophone African women writers, especially from Senegal. And as I mentioned before, Georgina has edited the first anthology of Francophone African women's poetry in English, The Other Half of History. Her own most recent publications then include a translation of a novel by Monica Sabolo, which came out earlier this year. And she has a critical monograph on Francophone African women's poetry coming out next year.
Hopefully, yes.
So, Georgina.
Thank you. I have a PowerPoint, so I'm going to come here, and hopefully you'll be able to hear me okay. Thank you ever so much for the invite. This is a real pleasure, and I've come down from Glasgow, and it's kind of nice to escape and do something completely different to my everyday job. My literary translation work started when I was at Warwick University studying translation studies, and I decided to compile an anthology of Francophone African women's poetry in French and also in English translation. I'd studied the negritude writers, Aimé Césaire, Léon Gontran Damas, and Léopold Zéda Zingor from Senegal. And I got frustrated because I couldn't find many women poets, and I was scouring the library. There was just the odd one. I'd pick up anthologies, just one women writer amongst, say, 20 writers altogether, and usually from the same writers as well, in the Maghreb and also south of Sahara. So people such as Assia Jabbar, Véronique Tadjot, Annette Mbé-Downeville. So I decided to create this anthology, and it was called The Other Half of History. The book, for me, was about providing a new forum for African women writers working and writing in French and introducing those writers to a different audience through translation, but also providing those source texts in French as well alongside the translation so people could read those source texts too, and that was another platform for those. It was about redressing the balance between male and female writers and also demonstrating the diversity of their work as well in terms of language, culture, style, subject matter, etc. And there was also a preface as well, thanks to John Morley, and I'll come to that in a second, and by Khadija Sese, who's an African writer herself. And yes, I met John Morley at Warwick University, and he was running Heaven Tree Press, as it was back then, and publishing anthologies of poetry and translation. So it was a very exciting time for us, and I've met several people since John that have also published with Heaven Tree, and it started their publishing career off, so it was absolutely wonderful. I'd like to just briefly introduce some of the writers that featured in the anthology. Wewe Liking from Cameroon, Alice Valette from the Congo. And my favourites were the Senegalese writers, and that's where my path took me, really. As I mentioned, Annette Mbe-Downeville, she's a very popular writer and had appeared in anthologies. Mamzik Mbake less so. Not many people had heard of her at the time, but I found her work really fascinating. The actual compilation of an anthology was difficult, searching for women's poetry. Thanks to, and I know Oxford University, you went to Oxford, didn't you? There were some wonderful books, pamphlets that I managed to find in, you know, squeezed between lots of other books, and it was quite exciting when you found a new poem. Also, SOAS was wonderful, and I did take trips to Africa. I was doing my PhD, Masters at the time, and so I didn't have a lot of money. But I managed to pick up what I could and collated an anthology of 29 female poets from 13 African nations, and it was the first of its kind in 2007. So the text searching was difficult, but also with the compilation of an anthology, I was really concerned about issues of representation and the potential criticism of the selection process. I knew I had to include lesser-known writers, well-known writers. They had to be geographically diverse, people from different time periods, et cetera, different styles, different subject matter. And there were also issues as far as translation was concerned. Was I domesticating the translation? Was I ironing out cultural difference? Which I think was common practice, if you know, a couple of decades ago. So I was concerned about that. And then there's also the issue of post-colonial texts, the criticism often that translation is neocolonialism, it's reacculturating a text through the process of translation into another colonial language. And in the past, translations generally, I think, have been criticised for prioritising meaning or layers of meaning, if you like, over style or limiting in some ways the layers of meaning in a text. So I was also concerned about my knowledge of so many different cultures within an anthology. So my research had to be really thorough. I tried to gain an understanding as much as I could of different histories, post-coloniality, issues of gender, orality, and I tried to mediate between those different cultures and languages. Cultural understanding generally for me has always been very important. And producing that book, that was always in the back of my mind. But I did feel that by not specialising, I could only get so far as cultural understanding was concerned. And so I decided to focus on the writers of Senegal and spend some time over there to understand the culture a little bit more. I interviewed Sokhna Benga. She's a poetry writer, but also she writes novels as well. And she said what was important to her was a respect for this, my culture, so that the foreigner, male or female, who's holding my text, my translated text, can feel what I feel. I don't see this as a need to adhere rigidly to the source text, however, but rather a need to understand again those layers of meaning and culture, history, style, in order to make more informed decisions in the translation process. And I interviewed, well, when I spoke to Sokhna Benga, I also started translating some of her works for academic purposes, but I've also published extracts of her work as well. And she's actually been very happy for me to manipulate texts and to prioritise certain aspects of style above those layers of meaning that I was talking about, because actually style is an integral part of culture as well. For example, how can you translate a text like this without an understanding of Senegalese cultures? N'écrit sans laisse. Le voile d'or d'un jarret, d'un daté, reine sereine, jambout n'bourge, la sublime, et l'âme malanguère. So this poem is full of historical references, and in particular the names of the kings and queens of the Wala kingdom of Senegal, well, that region as it was. And building bridges then for me has been about visiting and living in Senegal to get a greater understanding of the country. Finding more text there, which has been really difficult, as you were saying sometimes, ones that I couldn't find anywhere else. And I went to go to Gore Island off the coast of Senegal, and there was a women's museum there. And I was able to pick up all these wonderful books and pamphlets that had been published by independent presses there. And it was really very exciting to find all those new texts and incorporate them in my work going forward. I met activists such as the feminist politician Pendam Bo, who gave me a lot of insight into gendered language in Senegal. As I said, I met interviewed writers as well, and I also learnt some basic Wolof, which is one of the official languages of Senegal, but spoken by 80% of the people there. French is only spoken by 20%. So embracing culture and above all orality has always been important, but it can also mean, I think, quite significant changes in the translation process. When I first started out translating poetry for the anthology, I think I was relatively literal. I did take consideration of style, but I stayed quite closely to the source text. However, thinking a lot more about orality in African translation tradition is something that's much more fluid. And if we consider something like the African griot, who passes a text from one generation to the next, and each griot, as they pass down from generation to generation, adds elements of their own, perhaps because of issues of memory, but also issues of performance, and also because creativity is important in that translation process. I call it this kind of practice, translation as inspiration, always be influenced by the text that came before. So let's take this poem, for example, by Fatun Jai Sao. The literal translation then reads, "Mother of the earth, kneaded by your sweat, hot breath of the savannas, your pace, the rhythm of the halam." We could then rewrite that text, taking inspiration from the source text, and create something that really embraces orality and performance and takes its inspiration from the source. So, for example, "Mother of the earth, and your sweat beats your brow in the burning savannas of the Jolof. Your steps chase the rhythm as the griot strums the halam." So I quite like this more creative side to translation now, and I really do enjoy that. And if we go back to the poem I mentioned before, this one here, by Njekumban Bengijakate, we could, through an understanding of culture, through this concept of inspiration, create something that sounds more like this. We could call the poem Walo, after the kingdom. "Njare casts her golden veil over our stolen earth, over our serene kings and queens, from Yoff to the Senegalese River and beyond the Atlantic, long departed." So, just to move on then, all these poems that I've spoken about have actually been published relatively early, from Annette Downeville, who actually published before independence, right up until the early 2000s. But where are we now in terms of Senegal and literature and the potential for translation? Well, it's still very difficult to be published in local languages such as Wolof. It's considered to be a very limited market. There's some children's literature that's been published in Wolof, but little is written for adults, but by Birago Diop, for example. Mamze Kumbake, who I mentioned earlier, published in one of her collections a poem in Wolof that was accompanied by a creative French translation. And Une Si Longue Lettre by Mariama Ba, which is one of the most famous Senegalese women's texts, prose, was finally translated into the language that it probably should have been written in Wolof. However, education is still dominated by the French, or by French. As was mentioned before, it's a struggle for children, and it's quite limiting at university because French literature also dominates there. Which isn't then going to assist in promoting Wolof and publishing in Wolof as well. So we could say still that African literature from Senegal is very much in the margins, and therefore so are its translations. One good piece of news I discovered recently was that Une Si Longue Lettre has actually been translated as such into, or it's being adapted at the moment into a film version, which is quite exciting. And the director is a Senegalese woman, and the film will be in both French and Wolof. So I think that's a wonderful progression. So, yes, there's some improvement in the profile of Senegalese writers, but not a dramatic change. More broadly in Africa, flagship publications of recent years, like African 39, for example, have certainly made a difference to the profile of up-and-coming authors. It includes 39 writers from sub-Saharan Africa and the diaspora as well, writing in a variety of different African and European languages. Although, again, this criticism of selection, representation, and defining Africa as well. And we see very little in the news articles that promoted that text about the translators that played a key role in the publication. Much more broadly, however, it seems that the profiles of women writers do seem to be gaining more visibility globally and through translation. And talking of anthologies, another one I contributed to called Writing Revolution responded to events in the Middle East, the Arab Spring, by collating testimonies from writers, journalists, lawyers, researchers. And of the 9 contributors, 5 were women. One of the 2 editors was female, and all the texts were translated from the Arabic and the French. And I was the female translator, and there was a male translator translating from the Arabic. So this is just an example, one little example of how women writers and translators are sometimes considered to be marginal, but I think are playing a more visible role in writing and publishing today. I realise I might be talking for a long time, but I've got a couple more slides I'd just like to finish with. I would say then that translation throughout recent history has been very much a marginal activity in itself. Derivative, secondary, female, the words that we're often confronted with. It's harder to publish translations. There's less funding, as we've said, as we know that translations only form just a small percentage of the current market. Having said this, in the UK, we are embracing the foreign more readily now. There are more texts or translated texts written about other cultures in the bestseller lists. Texts such as Khaled Hosseini's The Kite Runner, I think, made many people embrace other cultures and issues of code switching within literature. Organisations such as the BCLT, the Free Word Centre, raised the profile of literary translation, as does International Translators Day. And then we have others such as the Society of Authors, the Translators Association, that actually protect the rights of translators legally. And then there's awards for translations as well, Penn, for example, and also the new Man Booker International Prize for Fiction in Translation, which recognises the work of translators as writers in their own right. And this is very significant for publishers, of course. Picador, who I just worked with, has only recently renewed its focus on translated fiction because awards such as this inevitably bring financial rewards. And it's therefore increasing the market for foreign literature. It's inevitably going to expand. Although, as we know, that will be most likely more of a struggle for poetry. So finally then, I just wanted to, because I come from Glasgow University, I know there's a number of academics here, I thought it was important to mention this and the issue of impact. Translation generally in academia is also being considered peripheral. And I'd say that the University of East Anglia is actually very different in that way, because for a long time it situated literary translation alongside creative writing. And creative writing positioning creative writing alongside literary translation means that we're bringing together the theoretical with the practical within academia. Within modern languages itself, it's been rare for translated literature to be submitted to the Research Excellence Framework, the REF. However, much research and creative activity always goes into producing a translated text. So why isn't it always included? I do see at Glasgow some changes, however. I wasn't able to put forward to the last REF a piece of translated literature. However, I do intend to for the next one. We have at Glasgow more creative writing workshops that incorporate literary translation, PhD theses, and now allowed to include 50% of literary translation work. So things are really changing, I think, in 3 key areas here, African writers, women writers, and also translators as writers. And I think events like today really raise the profile of all 3. So thank you very much for listening.
Thank you, Georgina. A wonderful overview of your project and its context. Time is moving on, and just perhaps to follow on from your last slide, I should mention that there is indeed a groundswell of thought about the question of translation as research in relation to the university environment and the Research Excellence framework, and there's been an open letter to the Arts and Humanities Research Council, which was begun by Nick Harrison at King's College London, and I'm pleased to say that I had the opportunity to sign VCLT up to, along with quite a number of other bodies within the translation and sector and within academia to that letter. So I hope things might be changing before too long. I had one question for you about the translation, about translation publishing within Africa and within Senegal, because so often, I mean, in a sense, following on from the question about publishing the Burmese anthology in the UK, and what is the situation for Senegalese writers and translators as far as publishing within Senegal or within Africa is concerned? How is the African publishing sector developing?
I think translation as itself in Senegal isn't, what's the word, I guess organised in some way. You know, there aren't many organisations that promote translation in Senegal, and there's little translator training as well. I think things are changing, just with Mariam Aba, the Mariam Aba translation into Wolof, but I would say because French literature is often prioritised and then translation into English is often prioritised, there's an issue there. And English isn't used that much in Senegal, so I think a lot of the translation is happening beyond the borders.
Hmm. Okay, thank you. I think we should move on then to our fourth panelist at this stage, and can I introduce Yrsa Daly Ward, who is a writer who fuses poetry with the other arts of music, storytelling, and theatre. Her first collection of stories on snakes and other stories was published in 2013, and more recently, her self-published book, Bone, was available on Amazon for Kindle and was an Amazon poetry bestseller in 2014. So I think Yrsa is particularly interested in the social media potential and online possibilities for translators and for publication and self-publication. And so I invite you to say a few words about those aspects.
Thank you for inviting me. Thank you. Okay, so my name's Yrsa Daly Ward, and I'm a poet, a writer, storyteller. I'm from, I have lots of identities that I claim, Nigerian, Jamaican, Northern, from Lancashire. And I was brought up in the Northwest in a place called Chorley with my little brother to a single mum. And in our house, it was just full of, there was poetry, there was storytelling. We were encouraged, we hated our stepdad. So we always used to write a lot of poetry about him, a lot of short stories about his fates. And we did all that kind of stuff. And when we were actually the only other black people in Chorley were part of our family, cousins and aunties and people like that. So there was a lot of code switching that actually happened. You know, we were part of this kind of very Caribbean household with very staunchly religious grandparents. And then we'd go to school and we'd be something else. And what happened in school, I always thought I would be a writer. I was always interested in that more than anything else. But what happened when I went to school was that poetry became a closed shop. Literature became a closed shop. It was boring. I couldn't really connect with it. And nobody around me, any of the other children that were there, didn't connect with it either. And so for a long time, even though I wanted to be a writer, I never admitted to it because I wanted to be cool and, you know, sexy and drink and do all those kind of things. But if we fast forward to when I was 18, I decided to pick it up again and wrote a novel. It was terrible. It was really awful. But what's interesting about that was that the main characters, there were four women, and all of the women were, they were white, They were nothing like me. They ate lasagna for dinner and chips, and we never did that. We had rice and peas and chicken and you know coconut and stuff like that. And I just could not see myself. I could not believe that if I wrote about my experience, my kind of multicultural experience and a varied experience, that it would be something that anybody would want to write. So for a long time after that, I was a writer that wasn't writing, and writers that don't write are just not good people. So I went to South Africa to kind of find myself years later, and ended up walking past this poetry cafe, and they were doing all of this spoken word, and then they set a prompt for the next week, and they said, write about discord in the family. And I thought, well, God, I can do that. So I went away, wrote it, and it was just this very simple poem about my, you know, Jamaican grandma commenting on my mum and my the current person that she was dating and what was happening there. And it just went down really well because I was writing about myself. I was writing the truth. And this kind of stuck with me. And then I ended up just going to do a lot of kind of poetry readings and kind of went around the spoken word circuit in South Africa and then came back here. And the British Council were wonderful here. They sent me back over to Joburg. I did loads of really fantastic, brilliant, exciting things. And then what happened on coming back to England was that I just, you know, I felt empowered. And I felt empowered because we were speaking to people who have a similar experience. And there's lots of people walking around with multicultural identities, multiple identities, you know, LGBT, women of colour, women, feminists, all of this stuff. And actually writing is such a bridge. It's such a way to connect with people when you're being honest about your experiences, when you feel free. And so I started this blog. And it's a great way, blogging, I didn't realise it's such a great way to kind of connect with other people who are poets, who are short fiction writers, who write flash fiction, all of this stuff. And it's just great the way everyone connects. And there was this brilliant writer, an African-American writer called Naira Waheed, and she has this wonderful bestseller called Salt. And she's amazing, isn't she? Yeah. And I one day was just writing on Twitter, oh, I think your work's brilliant. Not expecting her to answer, but I thought, why would you answer me? And then she got back, she said, do you want to Skype? I was like, yes! So we Skyped, and it was wonderful. And it just began a wonderful friendship. We met a writer from Zimbabwe called Tapiwa Mugabe. And the three of us were able to, actually, we only met online initially, but the three of us were able to co-release our paperbacks and Kindles. And they went on to do very well because we had formed a community. A community that isn't seen, isn't recognised. We all self-published through a publishing platform called CreateSpace. And it was just a wonderful way to kind of use social media, use Twitter, use our Instagrams to kind of push things up and bring them to audiences that don't, you know, that like poetry, but they don't get the chance to kind of engage with it. You know, younger people, older teenagers, people in their early 20s, for whom poetry is just kind of shut off, you know, because we're taught to believe it's this kind of upper-class literary circle. And it's not about that. It's about, you know, it's about feeling, it's about soul, it's about connecting. And we're all of us more alike than unalike, I believe. So, you know, poetry can be a net. Stories can be, you know, can be something that binds us together. So I think what I'm going to say in closing, because I know we have to be quite brief, but I think I'm really interested in using social media, because although you have Instagram, which is a picture, sort of picture sharing platform, but people do kind of repost, regram poetry. You see, you can have blocks of colour with writing on, and they do so well. I mean, people are dying to kind of be moved by literature and you know, words either spoken or just written down on a page. And it's still really exciting. And teenagers as well, people that we thought would never be interested in that kind of stuff, are interested in stuff because it's universal. So I think it's really important that this kind of we were able to kind of empower other people to write, to have their blogs, to write on Twitter, to write the flash fiction, and really kind of find new ways of expressing. We're in a digital age, so we have to go digital with this. So yeah.
I think translators don't need to be persuaded of the importance of the digital blogosphere and all the other aspects of the digital revolution. I'm just wondering, have you had much interaction with translators through your digital presence?
That's one thing I forgot to say. It's because you're so kind of accessible when you're on a lot of social media, kind of different types of social media. It's a lot easier for people to kind of drop messages into your inbox, or whether it's Twitter or whether it's Facebook. And I've had an Italian person and a Cuban person both kind of contact me through my website and asked me if they could translate poems and use them on like online magazines and printed magazines. And yeah, of course,
I just wanted to quickly add that if we didn't have, there were two female poets who we did find for Bones Will Crow. If they hadn't been blogging and they had a massive blogging presence in Southeast Asia, the names are Aindra and Pandora, we wouldn't have found them. And they are two exceptionally gifted poets. So I totally share what you're saying in that respect as well. It can circumnavigate censorship as well, which is great, obviously.
Okay, thank you. I think we move on to our final panelist then. And we'll hear finally from Deborah Smith, who has been a friend of the BCLT for quite a while, and most recently was a workshop leader at our recent international Translation and Creative Writing Summer School, which we organised with Writers' Centre Norwich in July. Deborah has made a very strong reputation for herself as a translator from Korean, and particularly has translated the work of the Korean writer Han Kang, and her latest translation of Han Kang, Human Acts, is going to be coming out next year, in January 2016. But Deborah is here really to, I think, talk with another hat on today as the founder of a new press, Tilted Axis Press. It's a new venture. She has a number of new titles in the pipeline, including one that we heard about earlier on. And I hope you'll be talking a little about the challenges for the publisher of publishing the kind of collection that you have coming out, and the ways in which you've responded to those challenges.
Oh, I don't know if I'm talking exactly about that, or certainly probably not really about anything being challenges, but similar stuff. Okay. Yeah, definitely. I keep saying stuff today. I'm sorry about that, and I'll try and talk as quickly as I possibly can. I made a rather jazzy slideshow, but unfortunately only finished it this morning and didn't send it to anyone, so I might be referring to quotes that you can't in fact see, but just trust that they exist. Okay, so Tilted Axis I set up to publish, I think we're probably now mainly going to be doing translations from Asian languages. Initially I wasn't really sure exactly what to call it, non-European, underrepresented, there's issues with all of these things, but it's turned out to be mainly translations from Asian languages. Not all translations, but mainly translations, and mainly by women. And the obvious reason is because there is practically nothing. I don't need to sort of go into set numbers or percentages, but the tiny percentage of literary fiction that does get published here, which is translation, an even tiny percent of that is from anything other than, French, German, Russian, a handful of big languages. And there are two, I think, main issues with that, although they're not actually separate, one representational, one of them artistic, both of which were part of my initial impulse in setting it up. So one thing is that it's the fact that these numbers are so tiny that makes representation an issue when it doesn't necessarily or shouldn't have to be, because it exacerbates publishing's inherent conservatism. So the idea that you have to slot in neatly with established ideas, reductive categories and stereotype labels is not at all exclusive to works in translation or to works from Asia. But the so-called burden of representation placed on the handful of writers who do manage to sneak through from countries like India or Japan, and these are within Asia, you know, relatively big countries where you can say there may at least be a handful as opposed to one or none, means that what's being labelled and categorised and packaged for consumption isn't merely a particular book or an author, but an entire literature, culture or region. And when it comes to authors from well-represented groups, say even UK writers, this tendency towards essentialising and stereotyping is still lazy and dull, which is bad enough. But when it's used towards writers from less well-represented groups, it can actually become a kind of violence. And so only yesterday, the Ghanaian author Taya Selassie wrote in The Guardian about this burden of representation. She wrote about two recent novels, one by Noah Igbaloyo, and how her book was castigated for performing Africa. It was dismissed as poverty porn because it focused on the lives of young Africans affected by AIDS and sexual violence. In the same article, she mentioned Chimamanda Adichie's novel Americana being criticised for falling at the other end of the spectrum, so featuring a wealthy, English-speaking, Atlantic-hopping minority. And the problem clearly isn't with individual authors, it's with the landscape as a whole, and it's the publisher's job to rectify this. The settings and characters of the two books I've just mentioned come from opposite ends of a spectrum, and that is the issue, the fact that conservatism, in the sense of publishers always wanting to go with what is a proven marketable formula, means that the spectrum gets collapsed to one or two points. Once you get one type of book, you keep getting that type of book again and again and again. And I don't mean to suggest that the point of publishing is to provide some kind of accurate proportional representation of a group. The point of publishing, or at least the kind of publishing I'm interested in, that aims to make a cultural impact to publish literature for readers, not products for consumers, is art, and that should always be the primary consideration. But I do think that while the media continues to perpetuate reductive, damaging narratives or deafening silence, that publishers should at least be aware of the factors that are shaping their choices of what to publish. And so I had some quotes from a couple of Indian writers, one called Janice Pariyat, talking about wanting the freedom to forget where you're from, the freedom to not be told by someone else, usually a Western publisher, what is an Indian theme, and to be asked for your writing to conform to that. And what is fundamental in that is the desire for writing to be regarded as art, not anthropology. And something that strikes a chord with me, because it's what I'm interested in as a reader, it's what I want to read, as a translator, it's what I want to translate, and so by extension as a publisher, it's what I want to publish. I know it's what other people are interested in as well. And this is the artistic argument. So really simply, having just a tiny percentage of books that we're able to read from, you know, a vast swathe of the world means that there is so much brilliant writing out there that we're remaining ignorant of. Exciting, innovative, sophisticated work that I want to be able to read for my own selfish reasons. Mm-hmm. And because I've been, you know, clued into first the translation and now the publishing communities, I know that the work is out there. Sometimes people say, oh, well, maybe it just doesn't get published because it's not really there, which is a bit silly. And I also know that implicit biases, that means it's unlikely to ever make it into English without an explicit push. Biases like editors being unable to read the original language, sales team reluctant to publish writers whose English isn't good enough for publicity purposes, which means even presses who aren't, you know, excluding work from certain languages or regions just end up not publishing it because it's easier not to. Aside from English, I can only read Korean, so I rely on translators as kind of regional editors. They have expert knowledge, often unique knowledge, and they have incredible enthusiasm, and I'm not just beating them up because I am also one. But I'm still shaping what we publish by the kinds of inquiries I make, where I'm directing them, what then takes my fancy from this. And so to try and sort of make it a bit less of a personal thing, some of this involves using quotas or telling yourself, okay, you're not doing this thing or you are doing this thing. So we don't now accept unsolicited submissions. because at the very beginning when we did, everything that we were recommended was either in English or a major European language like French. And that's always going to be the case if you have unsolicited submissions, because these are the books which are more likely to already have agents or translators attached to them, that they will have someone influential to recommend them, there'll be a cultural or a governmental funding source already in place. It will always be easier to finance a non-translation, just as it will always be easier to discover a non-translation or one from a European language. And that's why we've told ourselves, no, we can't do the English book from Singapore or the French book from Mauritius, not that we don't think they're good, not that we think they are in any way overrepresented. But we're a very small company, we're only doing 5 books a year, precisely because we want to devote as much of our attention and effort and money into each one. So if we let ourselves do those books, then we know we'll never do the novel written in Uzbek or the short story collection written in Thai. And we want to do those books because there is a case to be made for translation. And then I had some other quotes talking about publishing being a zero-sum game in the sense that certain regions, like particularly India, where there is a lot of writing in English, means that for every Anglo-Indian book that is published, it's almost as though a space is lost for a translation into English from an Indian language. And I didn't actually quite agree with exactly what they were saying. And one of the things I didn't agree with is that I didn't want to suggest that writing in local languages is somehow more authentic than writing in English, or that English in, you know, India is not a local language, their English is, and they're used in different ways. And also because this idea of authenticity sounds suspiciously a bit like something that has more to do with anthropology than art. But it's the numbers, again. I don't have a problem with what's being published. I've read a lot of Indian writing that was written in English that I really loved. It's the stuff that isn't getting published that we're missing out on. And the case for translation isn't to offer a window onto another culture, which is a phrase, again, that a lot of African writers who I follow on a blog have been, they did a whole sort of feature of posts sort of bemoaning the idea that they have to be providing a window onto another culture, that they can't just write. And then also, if the windows weren't so selective, then perhaps what we see through them wouldn't seem so other. But the case is to represent literary cultures and traditions that we're not getting access to. And that is exciting because they're often so different from the mainstream Anglophone or Western ones. When I first started reading translations from Indian languages like Bengali or Malayalam, I was shocked by how different they were from all the Anglo-Indian books that I read. And so the difference in itself is something that excites me. It's something that contributes to how I would define art, if I was sufficiently pretentious as to attempt to define art. But the kind of active intellectual engagement that's demanded of us when we're startled by something we haven't encountered before, when we're challenged into new ways of seeing, or when we're discomforted, like Oka was talking about earlier, I think that is actually in itself a definition of art, to be made uncomfortable. And variety or diversity in terms of languages, cultures, nationalities is important from a representational standpoint, but what I most want to explore with Tilted Access are varieties of form, of style, of language, and the way that these offset and or form part of what we think of as the book's subject and identity and all these other issues. So for one thing, outside the sort of Euro bubble, many literary cultures don't set such overwhelming stock in the novel, or at least the novel as we think of it, which means that the strength might be in the short story, as it often is in South Korea, in Japan, in I think some Indian languages as well, or in poetry, as it is, from what I gather, in Indonesia, in Vietnam, in Burma, I guess as well. I was then going to talk all about the first book that we are doing and how that kind of fits in with that, but I'm afraid that I probably don't have time to do that. So I will just finish up with saying that what I think the publisher's role and that what we're trying to do is to provide or enable or at least not be getting in the way of complexity, specificity and agency. And by complexity, I mean exploring all the many things a given book might be about, rather than reducing it to a single narrative. And by specificity, I mean the kind of details that make nonsense of certain categories, like the Indian writer. And by agency, I mean the freedom for the writer to choose their own labels, to not have them imposed on them by others. The Bengali writer that we are publishing writes these really sort of, she's a woman writer, she writes these sort of very hard-hitting gender politics books, and in her bio she wrote, "Sangeeta is not a feminist." And I was intrigued by that because it sort of made me suspect that this was a label that someone else had put on her and her work, and that she had found restrictive or reductive in some way. And it also sort of clued me into the fact that, you know, made me re-aware that these aren't concepts and terms that exist in a vacuum. They have specific contexts, and we have to translate between them. She writes in Bengali. She doesn't speak English. When she provided that bio for the publishing house, she would have provided it in Bengali. So I wonder what the word she used originally was, and what that translation, feminist, of that specific context is sort of missing out for us. And so, yeah, the freedom for then the writer to have what Janice Pariat said, the freedom to forget where you're from, equally the freedom to make things like inheritance and identity central to your work, but to be able to do that on your own terms. And none of this, the most important thing is that none of this is charity. None of this is some philanthropic testament to our own broad-mindedness. And it's also not inimical or opposed to actually selling books. We're a not-for-profit company. That means we have the scope to have considerations other than profit. But we still want to sell as many books as possible and get our books to as wide an audience as possible. But by replacing the usual question, will it sell, which is what editors often ask me as a translator when I'm trying to pitch something to them, which is actually a question that means, is it very similar to something that has already sold? With instead working from the basis of, okay, I want to publish this book, whatever it is, because it's an amazing work of literature, and often precisely because it doesn't fit in with exactly what has already been published. So then thinking, okay, how can I sell it? That gives us the opportunity to be creative in the way that we're reaching new audiences. If we afford our writers freedom of imagination, then their imagination will run riot to create, for example, a long poem presented as a sight and fair accessible art book, as Onka has done, or an experimental historical novel with proliferating subplots linked by poetry, as Hamid has done, who is sitting at the back there. And we will all reap the rewards. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Deborah. I think that was a great way of rounding off our panel. We've been hearing a great deal about daring to be different from writers, from translators, from editors, from academics, and now from a publisher as well. And I obviously wish you all success with your new venture. I don't know if there are any final questions either for Deborah or for any of our other panelists before we break. If there are any final burning questions.
I think the main issue, I'm not going to start a whole new round of this, the digital, isn't it? It's maybe for another translation.
Yes.
But it seems to me that a lot of what's been said here is about a crowded marketplace and therefore the competition and the strain of resources that results, and digital as a means of you know, freeing up people to communicate more widely as a means of opening up the avenues for simply more and better publication. It's obviously something we have to think about. We're preparing the next issue of In Other Words at the moment. Rice Centre is now the publisher of that. And, you know, we're putting out a questionnaire for readers to ask in November, you know, is this print issue working? Is it doing all that we need to be able to do from a translation journal? Or do we have to start thinking about digital options? Lots of publication in your CVs to some extent.
Going along with that, in terms of being extremely Machiavellian, thinking about the market, disabled people are the largest minority in the world, and there have been a lot of articles recently about how it's an untapped market because people simply aren't using those digital avenues to get to people who access stories in different ways. So that's really something to think about.
And it's exactly why Tilted Access has hired a dedicated digital producer, who is Simon Collinson, who is sat here. Because, yeah, it's something that the bigger publishers aren't really thinking about or haven't been thinking about. And again, it's that, you know, a lot of people in publishing seem to have taken the if it's not broke, don't fix it route and not realised that it kind of is broken. it's something that actually smaller publishers who are more flexible can tap into social media and, you know, just to make things more exciting in itself. I think it's a crowded market, so why put out more of the same?
One, yes, question in the front there.
I'm Korean writer. Deborah,
she wants to ask you.
Yes.
한국 문학 작품, 한가한 작품, 베지테리안 번역하셨는데, 한국이 문화적으로 굉장히 독특한 나라라고 생각하는데, 한국 문학 작품을 번역할 때 어려움이 뭐였는지.
She's asking, what are the difficulties when you translate Korean literature? Because according to your biography,
should I answer that now? Do we need to leave, or should I answer that privately? Maybe.
Okay, I think that might well be the best solution because we're eating into our coffee time, so to speak. So I think we'll perhaps leave you to sort that one out over coffee, but. Can I invite you to join me in thanking all five panelists on what's been a really fascinating discussion? Thank you.